standing on the bare ground, my head bathed by the blithe air and uplifted into infinite space, all mean egotism vanishes. I become a transparent eyeball. I am nothing. I see all. In the wilderness, I find something more dear and connate than in streets or villages. In the tranquil landscape, and especially in the distant line of the horizon, man beholds somewhat as beautiful as his own nature.
I thought for a change we would open up this episode of Your Brain on Climate with a little bit of Ralph Waldo Emerson, who was always banging on about nature and its healing powers and what it could do for us. And I have come outside to my garden, and I've done that because Lauren told me to. Who's Lauren? Lauren is today's guest on Your Brain on Climate, the wonderful Lauren Hall Rodell, an expert in biophilia and zoo dulcis, although we don't talk about that very much. That's like how nice it is to stroke fluffy animals. But biophilia is the idea that we as humans have an innate love for being in nature. It's not something learned. It's something that's much deeper than that. We evolved to be in it, and we know when we're in it that it can make us happy, and it can give us creative thoughts and put our mind at rest and generally make things better because of who we are and how we evolved. That's Lauren's thesis. She's written about it, and in this episode of Your Brain on Climate, she talks about it. There is something proper nice about being in nature, innit? And I recognise, I mean, I'm in a city now. You probably hear some cars in the background as well as the odd bird coming from the tree. I recognise it's a privilege, but it shouldn't ought to be, should it? One of the things we talk about in this episode is whether or not nature should be a right, or accessing nature should be a right. Because if it is true that it has some kind of deep re-energising power, then it seems to be one of them things that we should all get a chance to be in, not just posh people with loads of land, or in Lauren's case, people who live in incredible natural beauty. So Lauren joined me from Colorado in the States, where, you know, there is a lot of nature. She deliberately chose to be there. Not everybody can have that. Sounds amazing. Shouldn't we all have a go at being in nature? Shouldn't we all have a go at, oh, there's a helicopter. Well, that sort of proves my point, doesn't it? I love this episode. Very happy to be bringing it to you. And as always, if you hear this noise, it denotes wisdom. It means that someone, probably Lauren, has said something of great wisdom, which you would probably want to go and refer to later. You don't have to stop the show to do it. I'll put a little note in the show notes and you can go and check at your leisure. Please do tell me what you think of the show. Email me at hello@yourbrainonclimate.com, or you can find me on Brain Climate. Tweet at me there. Do drop me a review on your podcast medium of choice. And most importantly of all, if you have the opportunity to, if you like what I'm doing, go to patreon.com/yourbrainonclimate. Give me a couple of quid to keep this show on the road. I pay my guests, including Lauren. I think that's important. I think it respects their time. I think it means I get great conversations with great people.
Your brain on climate.
Have you always lived in the middle of the countryside, or is it something you've done later on in your life?
It is something that I did later on. I grew up in Southern California in the San Diego suburbs, and by all rights, I guess I should have been a surfer, but I was always drawn to the mountains and to wilderness from the time I was a little kid. So I had a tendency towards what one might think of as biophilia. Probably from the time I was, probably 7 or 8. And I spent a lot of that time at the San Diego Zoo because my whole family worked there. So it was really easy for my mother to get me out of the house and into an environment that I could really thrive in. And I would just go to work with my dad. I'd be there at the zoo before it opened and long after it closed. And that's kind of how I spent my summers. Then eventually I was in an explorer post troop. It was a co-ed troop. And we would do a week in the Sierras or a week at the Grand Canyon, or a week, you know, somewhere else, and just backpacking. And I would say I was a hardcore wilderness advocate, an outdoors person from the time I was probably, 15 on. It was very formative. So even though I lived in a suburb, I spent all my waking moments either on horseback or in the wilderness. At that time in Southern California, you could live in the suburbs and still have horses. That is no longer true. So those were the good old days, Dave. They really were.
Yeah, you can't have horses in South London where I am either. Do you think that when you were a teenager spending time in the wilderness, looking back on it now, has that made you part of the person you were today? What's it given you?
Well, it's given me a strong sense of not just resiliency, but a feeling of being able to conquer almost anything. Because a lot of those times I was solitary. I wasn't in organized activities in a controlled setting. I tended to ride for hours alone. Yeah. To a friend's house that may be in 4-H. And for UK listeners, 4-H is an agricultural club for youth. And I might ride 2 or 3 hours without a cell phone, because back in the day.
Oh, wow.
And then when I got to my destination, I would call my parents and say, I made it. And then I'd ride 2 or 3 hours back alone with no cell phone. And I did that for so many years that eventually being alone in wilderness, and I've done some solo trips, it just felt natural. And I felt competent and capable. And I have a feeling those formative years doing that made a lasting impression on how I view the world and how I view myself in it, what I feel capable of doing. And maybe when I need to rely upon others for assistance, I'm not really good at that, but I'm getting better.
So you're getting at something there, which is what we're talking today, and you mentioned it, this idea of biophilia. So one of your hypotheses in your book, Renaturing, which I've read, and it's extremely good, and one of your hypotheses is that humans need, psychologically, mentally, developmentally, we need to spend time in nature. And it sounds like you're drawing on a large part of your own experience for that. But tell me a bit about how you ended up writing this book and what the core of your idea is.
It's kind of a long journey and a long story, but when I step back away from my own childhood experiences and I want to look at something through a more theoretical perspective, not so much, what has been my experience, but what do humans in general think about nature and how can we thrive and how can we be at our best self, especially in times where climate change, population concerns, our mental health is just getting really troublesome for society. I thought, well, how do I understand this in a larger sense? And so my journey began actually with studying attention restoration theory that was suggested by a professor. And he suggested that given my background with animals, so I've been a falconer and a horse trainer and a dog trainer and a zookeeper, he suggested that maybe I look at attention restoration theory through the lens of what happens to the brain in various ways, we presume beneficial when one interacts with animals, either domestic or wild. And that became became the thrust of my PhD work. And in the course of pursuing that, I really drilled down on the brain itself and what sort of mechanisms are chemical, neurological, the nuts and bolts of what's happening, rather than how people feel about what's happening. And sometimes they're the same, and sometimes they're not. And I just found that so fascinating. I almost couldn't help myself. I almost became addicted to studying neuroanatomy of the brain, a place I never really thought that my research would go. But it was just extraordinary, and I'm still fascinated by it to this day.
And so what is attention restoration theory? I guess the theory of how you restore your attention?
Attention restoration theory holds that there's processes in the brain that can be exhausted, just like lifting a weight over time. If you're doing bicep curls, eventually that muscle exhausts. And even though you might want to continue, at some point you really simply cannot. That arm will not lift until it rests. Attention restoration theory holds that attention, executive attention, voluntary attention, those are words that mean we are training, deliberately training our attention onto a task. It's not something that's automatic. It's something we're forcing ourselves to do because we have to, because we're driving in heavy traffic or studying for a midterm exam or taking the, you know, SAT or something. Something exhausting. And at some point, you just sort of crap out. And no matter how badly you want to keep going, you just can't, because that muscle, that brain muscle, is exhausted and empty.
Which I think we all recognize, right? Like I recognize that in myself, particularly we're speaking in my time at the end of, it's a Friday at the end of the week, and I'm feeling pretty attention knackered out, to be honest.
I can understand that. I feel that way too, and pretty much everybody does. Some people have more capacity for focused attention than others. Mine's pretty short, frankly, which is probably why I'm drawn to restoring in natural environments and in a natural space that's pleasant and that presents certain things like capacity for soft fascination. So that babbling brooks and singing birds and playing goats and whispering trees, that's a safe environment that allows soft fascination to shut down totally the part of your brain that's already fried and ready to be shut down. But it starts up something else called the default mode network. And when one is in that network, you are in the presence of something that's soft fascination, and you can relax, you can rest, digest, restore, you can think outside the box, you can problem solve with more creativity. And I can tell from kind of both personal research and just personal experience that when I'm feeling the way you're feeling today, Dave, at the end of the day on a Friday, that if I step away from my duties in my home office and I step outside and I start walking in nature on a nice day, it takes me about 12 minutes. And suddenly I'll have insights that I thought, I can't help but think, why didn't I see this before? Because I literally couldn't.
Yeah.
So that's so attention restoration theory says spend time in nature. And if you feel fried, you're really fried and you're really stuck, then take a break.
So there's a couple of things going on in there, and I guess it's important to separate them, right? So one is, if you're feeling fried, take a break. And then the other one is, if you're going to take a break, taking it in nature is better. Have I got that distinction right?
You do. Of course, when you take a break at all and you get up and walk around, that gets you away from the big blue screen. And it does engage parts of your eyes and your consciousness more readily. Just getting up and walking around is helpful. But when you're really fried, let's say on a long-term basis, and you're suffering from chronic stress or burnout, which are two separate things, although they can overlap a bit, then you need to spend consistent time in nature daily, every week, walking at least 30 minutes, 5 days a week is the general rule of thumb, in order to maintain a certain kind of chemical balance in your brain that allows you to be at your best, at your smartest, and at your most sane, really, so that your mood is not impaired by what's going on in the way of the chronic stress or the chronic demands upon your attention.
Because I'm going to get in a minute to the why nature is so great in particular, but I definitely recognize, and I'm feeling it at the moment, but I recognize in general that sort of overstimulation, that feeling of having so many things to look at and listen to. And I'm here right now talking to you, and there's a train going past, there's a train at the end of my garden, and I'm looking at the train, and there's so many things to look at and news and things to click and phones to mess about with. And that feeling of like, when I'm in the middle of a nice forest somewhere, most of that can't get me. And I know that feeling. So there's definitely a lot to be said, I reckon, for going somewhere without that stimulus, right?
True. And what you're sort of focusing on with those various distractions, those are all things that are composed of hard fascination, which is not the same thing as the kind of fascination that we experience that's restorative. So those things like the train going by are unnatural things that are a little bit alarming. You know that you know cognitively that the train's not going to hit you, but the sound of a train is not something we've evolved with. It's, you know, the sound of horns honking and sirens and helicopters. Those things all grab our attention in an important but continually draining way. So you can acknowledge all these things, and there's a complexity that is draining. It's very draining. But the complexity of soft nature, pleasant landscapes, there's even more complexity, but of a different kind that we evolved with to recognize as a place where you can rest and digest. There's no emergency. There's no need for a fight or flight response to something happening. And so attention restoration says that's why this is very different, that an urban environment does things to you, but a natural environment that's safe and attractive does things for you.
Oh, I love that. And there's something when I was reading your book that sort of took time to dawn on me, I think. And I think I was a little bit skeptical about it at the start. And then I thought about it some more and I thought, no, this is right. And the thing is that, like, when, in order for us to relax, in order for us to turn off, kind of what you just said, we need to be somewhere that feels safe, right? Kind of by definition. If there's things yammering at us or cars coming at us or, you know, bad stuff around, we're not going to relax and we're not going to go to our nice, happy place. And that there's something, by definition, like the noises of a bit of nature with birds singing and stuff like that kind of implies that everything's all right in here, you know. And there's, and I love the thing when you talk in your book about how when a forest goes silent and we know that's bad news because we know there's something bad happening. So tell me a bit more about the, you know, what's so restorative about being in nature.
Well, it sort of harkens back to a number of psychoevolutionary theories, and there's a number. So I will just focus on one that I spoke recently about at the agricultural conference I was talking at. And one of the things that is most restorative to farm visitors is if they can go and see a pasture where it has just the right number of features like trees spaced just at a certain distance, and all the animals, so let's say cattle, it might be sheep or horses or whatever, they're all relaxing, chewing a cud, they're all aligned more or less northward, and they're just at ease. That is incredibly relaxing, and it harkens to savanna theory, which says, this is where we evolved. This is where we are most comfortable. And these signals, many of them subliminal, will tell us, and we don't even know why consciously, that all is right with the world. So visitors to a farm where that particular vista is presented to them, they automatically find themselves just sitting on a bench, unable to move because it's so awesome. And yet it sounds so bland. A bunch of cows facing the same way, who cares? But it is it is a part of our deep subconscious.
What's the northwards bit of it?
I'm not really sure. I think it's more of an animal-related thing. There has been research that show that herbivores that are happy, and I presume this is in the northern hemisphere, when herbivores are happy and content and safe, and they're at leisure, They just, for reasons I'm not sure of, and I'm not sure that anybody knows this, but they have observed consistently that animals at rest tend to just lay down or stand facing north. They're just happier that way. I don't know why, but I wish I did. It's an interesting question.
My cat is currently facing north, although she's very much not at rest because she's trying to get out the window and kill some things. But she's currently facing north. I can testify. And you also write about the smells of nature as well. And this is, so I'm someone who, I'm talking about the two things I think that most kind of overstimulate me. I'm very sensitive, as I think you are, because you write in your book, to noise. And I'm very sensitive to kind of things smelling bad. And you write really beautifully in your book about the smells of nature. And tell me more about that and why that acts to restore, but certainly you.
Smell's kind of a personal subject, and a lot of people don't like to talk about it, but I don't mind. For me, I
you wrote a book about it.
I'll
so
talk about it. What the heck? So I like smelly things, things that a lot of other people don't care for because of the associations, but they are natural smells. As I mentioned in the book, dog poop on a sidewalk. No, that really plugs me in. It elicits a sense of everything is not right with the world. People are messy.
Okay.
And, you know.
Good.
Yeah.
Good. Just checking you weren't going to come out as a dog poo fetishist. No, all right.
No,
fine.
I mean, I'm just, yeah. And things are better now. But in Southern California, in those hot baking afternoons, there was a cultural norm for many years when I was growing up that you don't pick up after your dog. You just don't. That's bourgeois. You just don't do it. Well, now everything has changed. But I do have a negative association. So that particular smell, even though it's an animal smell, that particular one plugs me in with a negative association. But other animal smells don't bother me at all. Hmm. I rather like them.
Like goat poo?
Goat poo. Actually,
you're a fan of goat poo.
Goat poo really doesn't smell very strong, despite what people might think.
I bet it does. I bet it does to most people, just not to you. I bet you're... we should clarify here for the listener that Lauren keeps goats.
Yes, I've probably gotten used to it. But cat odor bothers me. So I have two cats, two indoor cats, and I keep the house absolutely odor-free. Maybe it's that herbivore smell reminds me of zookeeping and reminds me of horses and other pleasant herbivores, but carnivore poo, uh-uh. And I realize that it takes me down a notch. It disturbs me quite deeply. I become annoyed. I become angry when I smell those odors. And so it's having a profound effect on my brain, on my mood, on my ability to function and focus. So that's why I really focus on trying to get rid of those carnivore smells. Other people might find those same natural odors restorative and pleasant. There's not a lot of theory about that. There is some that says we tend to have a disgust and aversion response to certain bodily odors or natural processes that are decadent, as in decay and disease and those kinds of things that might eventually make us sick. And so we do tend to have a somewhat standardized response to those. But other than those standard responses, our preferences for odors can be all over the map. Now, I like to tell people if they're stuck indoors in Colorado and they have cabin fever, they really need to pay attention to bringing herbs into their smellscape. They need to, I prefer basil and rosemary, rosemary for memory and basil for just general good mood. But other people might have other preferences, but it goes right straight to certain parts of the brain that we don't tend to pay a lot of attention to now scientifically, but there is an emergent school of thought that has kind of started in Europe, but we Americans are catching on here belatedly as to how important smells are, natural ones, to overall good health and mental stability.
Your brain on climate.
I'm interested in how we define nature for the purposes of this? So what I'm hearing is get out into nature. It acts to restore you, restore your attention. It's good for your mental health on a kind of deep level that you might not understand. This is what I'm hearing. But a lot of people don't live in nature. They live in tower blocks or they live in the middle of cities. I'm lucky. I live in a city in London, but I've got a beautiful park just over there. Will that do? Will a garden do? Will looking at a tree do? Will looking at a picture of a tree do? Like, where do we stop? Where do we draw the line on what nature is?
Well, it's a continuum, Dave. And so what you've actually just described is the perfect continuum. So if I'm sitting at my computer and let's say I'm visiting a big city and I still have to work. So I'm in a hotel room. And for one reason or another, my break has to be done in my hotel room. The best thing I can do is listen to bird song on the computer and look at trees on the computer. It has some effect that is beneficial, but it's small. Wow. Then the next step up would be being able to walk down a pleasant suburban street lined with chestnuts, you know, trees and whatever. That's going to have a larger effect. Then the park is going to have a larger effect. And so the more nature you have, the greater the effect and the faster the amelioration of the negative things that are going on inside your brain pan because the chemicals have been either imbalanced or exhausted. So you don't have to necessarily have wilderness. I mean, I do, but I'm very lucky and I have chosen where I live very deliberately in order to have wild nature right outside my door. But most people can't. But if they can make a weekly sojourn and stay a couple of hours in a more wildernessy type of nature, that has tremendous effects that aren't just immediate. They will be, but there's research that shows that they're very long lasting and they can eat those, depending upon how many weeks you might, let's say, pursue this particular endeavor to get out in nature more and go out into the countryside a long ways and stay there for 3-4 hours even with your family. Sometimes it's best to be with a group of others. Sometimes it's best to be solitary. It just depends on your personality type and takes a little experience, a little practice to get to know who you are and how much nature you need, where and what kind. But for people that don't have it close by, if they can get out like on the weekends and spend several hours, then there are residual effects that are beneficial that can be protective against mood disorders. It helps with depression and anxiety, but it can also help with long-term cognitive processes so that you're going to be less at risk eventually for even Alzheimer's and mild cognitive impairment, which I think is a pretty powerful motivation to take that trip and get out into the countryside.
Yeah, it makes me think about, firstly, the importance of urban nature as well. Like, you know, there's so many, again, London's a pretty green city where I live. So even, you know, even in the sort of most urban areas, you might see some trees around the place, but it points to the importance of that. It points to the importance of having plants in your house if you can. If there's something, you know, if there's something that you can draw just from looking at a pot plant like I'm doing now, it points to that. And it makes me think, I know this is something people do talk about, but it makes me think almost at the level of kind of rights. Like if this stuff is so fundamental to how we've evolved and if it can be so restorative and if people who live near nature get somehow more than people who don't, it makes me think it's almost like we should have a right to this stuff. Have you ever thought about that? That there should be a right to access nature in some form?
I've thought about that a lot. And there are actually some studies being done in Germany and Scandinavia that are trying to put a little bit of data behind the need for this right. So it doesn't sound too airy-fairy. There's, you know, compelling evidence. I'm not sure that it's catching on in the U.S. very much, but in other countries, there does seem to be talk, at least, about a human right to access to nature. Urban greening, urban gardens are being examined with whether or not they're efficacious for meeting that need and, you know, fulfilling those rights. But I think we here in America are a bit behind. I think we're going to catch up rapidly. But I think Europeans are delving into that with a bit more seriousness, which I think is very encouraging. But I'm concerned because as an American citizen, I see that denying people the right to access nature freely in whatever form, but some form, is making us a little dumber. It's making us a little meaner, and it's making us crazier. And I'm very concerned about that.
Talk to me a bit about the chemicals. You mentioned a few times, you know, that being in nature changes your chemical balance. So what are the main chemicals at work? I love hearing about these. Are we talking serotonin and dopamine, and what else is going on?
Serotonin and dopamine would be the main mood modifiers, and the importance of time in nature is that it balances dopamine and serotonin in a healthful and helpful way. So dopamine is kind of a fast hit. It's woohoo, you know, and it dissipates.
Is that like when your mobile phone gives you a little notification? That's a little dopamine hit, isn't it?
It can be. Yeah, it can be if it's good news. And there's lots of things that give us a dopamine hit. They can be food. They can be interactions with some kind of a pleasurable substance, a pleasurable scene, laughing at a party. That's great. But time in nature does release dopamine, but more importantly, it releases serotonin, which is longer lasting. It's more subtle in its effects, but it's more beneficial overall as far as the long-term changes that it either promotes or facilitates, so that if you're already in a good mood when you go into nature, you will stay in a good mood longer because of more serotonin hitting your system. Dopamine is more, there's more of a crash. Serotonin, especially that you derive in nature, doesn't have a crash. There's no sugar low an hour after being in nature.
It sounds like what you're describing is the difference between having like a really strong coffee, which gives you a hit and it makes you feel awake temporarily, versus having had a really good night's sleep, which makes you feel kind of awake for the whole day and you don't get that crash. And the serotonin is basically that more long-term good mood kind of chemical, right?
Yeah, more or less. It may not last all day, but it lasts for hours. And the important thing is it's minus the crash. So dopamine will, it feels good. It's faster. It's more potent, but there is a crash. And that's what keeps people in sort of, in an urban setting, they keep in sort of a negative spiral of, okay, well, I feel bad now, so I'm going to need another hit of whatever it is. When you have sort of a serotonin baseline balance, you might not get those righteous highs that make you feel high, but then you don't get the crash later either. And time in nature has been shown through numerous studies using fMRI scans of the brain that show where the brain is lighting up, but also blood tests and saliva tests and things that say, okay, here's what's circulating, here's what's going on with you, how do you feel? And then people can kind of match how they're feeling with what the researchers are seeing. And the conclusion is that nature is better for you when it comes to keeping the happy hormones balanced in a sensible, long-lasting way.
Okay, so last question, Laurie. Thank you so much for coming on here. This is a podcast about climate change, sort of. Mostly, sometimes, occasionally. And we've talked a lot about being in nature and kind of how it is good for you and helps you restore and catch your breath and get your brain in order and all that stuff. What do you draw, what do you think being in nature can do for us in thinking about climate change, how to think about it, how to live in it?
Well, I've been thinking a lot about the idea that the most restorative landscapes that we can immerse ourselves in for the most effect are green, and they're stable environments where we aren't afraid of nature. We're not afraid of that afternoon storm. boiling up and wiping us off the face of the earth. They are safe spaces. They are natural, beautiful, complex, aesthetically appealing, safe spaces to be in. And with climate change, those opportunities may shrink because we may be looking at a climate where the weather weirding is more the norm, and it makes it more unpleasant to go outside. It makes it sketchier. It makes it riskier. It makes it less restorative. With especially in the west of the U.S., drought makes things a lot less green. Wildfires are something where if you buy a nice house and you're in nature and you've got a beautiful forest around you and it burns, it will impact your mental wellness for years before the forest can come back. You look out onto a blackened mess that looks like Mordor. And I know, Dave, that now you know that Mordor is part of the Lord of the Rings. But that whole...
People have told me that's the case. People have told me that's the case.
Yes, well, it's very ugly, and it's not restorative at all. So climate change is a threat to our ability to get out into restful nature and know that it's there, know that it's unchanged, undisturbed. It's naturally complex in a beneficial way that captures our imagination, our attention, and it kind of looks like the ideal environment that many of us crave without even realizing that we crave it. We don't really know what we're missing. And I was fascinated by the fact that I read an article today, I think it was the BBC, and it was about burnout among barristers, I think, in Wales. And they did a kind of a little bit of a, I guess you'd say an expose, a tiny one, about burnout in professionals. And I thought it was interesting that, and today being the 9th of February, I thought it was interesting that the pictures they showed were always of professionals in nature resting around a seaside, maybe on a yoga mat or at a mountaintop. And then when they said, what is it that these folks need to do in order to recover from burnout, nature was not mentioned at all. And I think there is a societal, a prejudice against understanding the importance of these restorative environments. We sort of unconsciously know that this is what we need, which is why those pictures showed that. But consciously, society still wants us to eat right, exercise, take yoga and get plenty of rest. And time in nature is almost never mentioned. So I worry a bit that keeps us from realizing what climate change might steal from us, might steal from our eventual cognitive wellness, might steal from our mental health right now, might steal from us as far as just longevity. As long as society continues to focus on other very important things, but leaves nature out of the conversation, I'm concerned that that's going to keep people from realizing that climate change isn't just about disasters. It has a much greater impact on all people, including me here in the Rockies. I mean, I can see it because we're living in a drought, and there's a lot of talk about that. And I feel sometimes guilty for even turning on the garden hose and watering my lawn because you're not supposed to do that. And yet lawns with trees are very restorative. And so I feel conflicted. And a bit of my restorative experience is hampered, is tarnished by the cognitive dissonance I feel that, okay, I'm staring at this beautiful lawn in a dry place. It shouldn't be this dry. Colorado has never been this dry, but it's going to get drier. So that's my concern, is that we're underestimating the effects of climate change on our ability to be in nature, a nature that we can appreciate, admire, and relax into. And if we can't relax into it, it's not going to do us any good.
The Lauren, thank you so much for coming on Your Brain on Climate. Tell people how they can find out more about you and your writing and your stuff.
Oh, well, thank you, Dave. It's been such a pleasure to be here and to talk with you. I've really been looking forward to this. It's been delightful. And people can find my work. I have two. The one we've been discussing is Renaturing, and it's available on Amazon, Renaturing. And then I have another book that touches on it, that is more focused on our the restorative benefits of interaction with animals, and it's called Zoodulcis, and it's my word, so I'm going to spell it Zoodulcis as in going to the zoo, Zoodulcis. So it's the sweetness of animals, and it refers to the benefits of interacting with animals, like Dave and his cat, in order to help you relax and restore at the end of a day or a week or a year. Or a life.
Well, it's all very well. Yeah, I think 50% of my interactions with Maggie Cat are restorative, and the other 50% get me bitten. So very much a lottery what sort of relationship we're going to have. Lauren, thank you so much for coming on, and all the best.
Thank you, Dave. Take care.
Right, brilliant. Thank you, Lauren. Thank you so much for coming on Your Brain on Climate, and thank you for listening. You can drop me an email, hello@yourbrainandclimate.com. You can tweet at me @BrainClimate, and you can please leave me a review on your podcast medium of choice, and consider going to the patreon.com/yourbrainonclimate to chuck me a couple of quid, or email me if you want to do a one-off donation and you don't fancy that Patreon thing, which Lauren, bless her, does. I will be back next time. Until then, well, you know what the advice for this episode is, don't you? Turn off your pooter, put it away, go and leave the house. And even if the best thing you can find to look at is a bit of grass growing out of a stump of a wall, go and look at that. Because you never know, it might inspire you to think somewhat more calmly about the world and climate change and what the hell to do about it. Okay, bye.